The following program is being brought to you on the Voice America Business Channel. For more information about our network and to check our additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericabusiness.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the following program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.
Are you looking for more customers for your business? Are you facing new competitors, not just across town, but across the country? How about across borders? How about worldwide? Welcome to Global Reach with your host, Tay Revez. As new technology makes it easier to connect with your customers, it also makes it easier for international competitors to reach them. Our program will help you stay competitive in a tough marketplace. Now, here's your host, Tay Revez.
Hi, everyone. Welcome back to Global Reach. This is a show that helps your business find opportunities, manage risks, and develop strategies for winning in the global marketplace. This week, we're going to talk about competition one more time. We all yearn for a return to the economy of the 1990s when the U.S. was the envy of the world. 20-plus million new jobs, soaring investment, soaring productivity, low inflation. My personal portfolio has never been so good. How did the U.S. do it? Was it tax cuts? Was it slashing government spending? Was it balancing the budget? Well, none of the above, says this week's guest, Dr. Paul A. London. He's the chief economist of the Stern Group, trade advisors in Washington, and he's the author of The Competition Solution. He says that the bipartisan secret behind America's glorious prosperity during the 90s was decades of bumpy political struggles that brought real competition to key industries, to transport, steel, retail, finance, telecom, and this liberated people's vital energy, allowing new entrants, stimulated innovation, and forced prices down. And that produced the 1990s prosperity, not the luck of the Clintons. Paul, welcome to Global Reach. I've been trying to get you on here for a long time.
Oh, I'm glad to be here.
Before we go on, I want to tell the audience a bit more about you. Paul London brings a wealth of experience and know-how to the Stern Group, which is headed by my former classmate, Paula Stern. He has served on corporations, he served trade associations, law firms, consultancies, all in the areas of manufacturing, healthcare, energy, utilities, not to mention the fact that he held top-level positions at the U.S. Department of Commerce during the 1990s. He was a senior policy advisor representing Commerce on the White House Task Force for Medical Errors, the Health and Hospital Services Task Force on Healthcare Privacy, one of my other favorite topics, and on the interagency groups that focused on healthcare costs. He was also Deputy Undersecretary for Economics and Statistics. In addition, he has served as a visiting fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, the executive director for the Coalition of Northeastern Governors, deputy assistant administrator for conservation policy at the Federal Energy Administration and the Department of Energy, and is executive director of the New England Economic Research Office, an arm of the New England Congressional Caucus. Formerly, he served as a legislative assistant to Senator Walter F. Mondale in the U.S. and a U.S. State Department Foreign Service officer. This is tremendous experience. He's written articles in the area of political economy, benefits of price competition, and its impact on the overall economy at the industry level. He's been published in the Huffington Post, the New York Times, the New Republic, the Houston Chronicle, Newsday, and a bunch more. And in addition to his book, The Competition Solution, he authored one of the first books on privatization titled Merchants as Promoters of Development in Rural India. It was a case study. I just got the title wrong. It is Merchants as Promoters of Rural Development, an Indian case study. Paul, again, welcome to Global Reach.
No, this is going to be fun. I'm looking forward to our conversation.
So am I. So why did we do so well in the Clinton years? Was it the luck of the Clintons?
Well, I think Clinton was a terrific president. He's very flexible. He always knows where he's going. He may have to take some detours, but he knew he really understands how the economy works and at least as important, how to make an economy, how to make the arguments to the public, the American public, about the economy. So I think Clinton had a great deal to do with the success of his 8 years, and it was really unprecedented. It was one of the longest, or probably the longest period of economic growth, really surging economic growth that this country has ever had that was not in wartime.
I think it was our true Belle Epoque. It was absolutely a vibrant time to be doing business. And really, we had a look at all boats floating. At least
everybody was, at the end of the period, unemployment was down below 4%, which people had thought was impossible. No one thought you could get down to 3.9%. I have to say, I always thought you could, but and I think you could go lower. But people were afraid of inflation. The Clinton period, there was no inflation. But I, the book talks about things that were the preconditions for this Clinton success.
Okay, so I was going to say, Paul, did this just spring new hatched with the election of Clinton?
Oh, no. And I think it goes back a long way, even into the 60s. At the end of the 60s, you know, we came out of the Second World War. We were the only economy still standing. So people in the United States were, you know, companies got fat and happy, and they were very dominant. The big three automakers, big steel, everything was big in the United States, and these companies got sort of fat and happy. And people understood, even at the end of the Johnson administration, that these companies were doing well because they had almost monopolies. They were oligopolistic companies, and people were concerned about that in both parties.
Now, what do you mean by that? Well, during the 60s, that was my Econ 101 days, the professors always said the U.S. was a free market economy, a competitive economy, a capitalist economy. Were they wrong?
I think they were probably compared to other countries. We had open markets. People would tell you, you know, that are relatively easy to import into the United States. There was a fair amount of competition. It wasn't like in some of the European countries. But there wasn't as much competition as we needed. And, you know, when I see prices going up, when I see people very concerned about inflation, I always think there must be an element of monopoly here, because most new inventions, most new capital equipment makes things cheaper than they were before, not more expensive. And we were always concerned during the 60s and into the 70s with inflation. And which, again, I link to a weak competitive environment. The automobile companies routinely raised prices. Steel companies routinely raised prices. And they could get away with it because competition wasn't very strong.
Talk a little bit more about them. Let's look at those two sectors just briefly. In what way was it an oligopoly?
Well, there were basically, first time I went to Washington, I was just a boy, in 1957. It was for a discussion of the automobile industry in the antitrust subcommittee. And all the big three automakers came in and said, Walter Reuther was there, who's head of the Automobile Workers Union. And he wanted to produce small cars because Volkswagen was starting to come into the United States. And the auto company said, no, you can't make small cars in the United States. Can't make money that way. And they operated like they were allowing Volkswagen to take a piece of the industry because they didn't want to compete with them on price. And they pushed American Motors out of the industry because American Motors was trying to build small cars. That was George Romney's, the father of candidate Mitt Romney. George Romney wanted to produce small cars, and he complained at those hearings that the big three were making it hard for him to raise money and were trying to push him out of the market. And they were able to do it. And
that was a period American cars weren't known for their quality.
They were not known for their quality. And, you know, you could buy a Volkswagen then, and they used to advertise a Volkswagen would go 250,000 miles. American cars went 60 or 70,000 miles, and they were finished. So this was a period when we didn't make quality products, but we had such a these three companies were so dominant in the market that they could get away with it. And so in the at the end of the Carter administration, when this skips a long way ahead, in 1980, the decision was made in the International Trade Commission that it was not the Japanese were taking a bigger piece of the American car market because they produced small cars and consumers wanted small cars and the American companies weren't making them.
And oil prices were up at that point.
And yes, and oil prices were up. And Carter did the courageous thing. He could have reversed that decision. And he could have protected the American car companies and the American market against low-priced, small imports. But he didn't do it. And he lost a lot of votes because of that. But Carter, I was surprised.
Re-elected.
Huh?
And was not reelected.
He was not reelected. But he did a lot of courageous things, which, for example, we're talking about it. He broke up the cartel that was keeping trucking prices high. He was very supportive of opening up the AT&T monopoly in telephones. He was a very courageous president, and in some sense, Ronald Reagan right after him, and certainly Bill Clinton rode on his willingness to make these tough decisions which expanded competition in the United States.
And I think you said also President Ford took some very courageous steps.
He absolutely did.
Speaking of Ford, I had a client from Ford who was talking to me, I think in the late 80s, and he said, we shouldn't have waited for the Japanese companies to make us competitive and to raise our quality. We should have been doing it right along. So it was a very interesting.
You know, that's my view. And of course, people tried to. There were people who saw this, but these companies were so successful. They were at those hearings in 1957. Senators came in, Everett Dirksen from Illinois, and he said, how can you criticize these companies for not making small cars? These are the most successful companies in America. So they were making a lot of money and had a very good reputation. But, you know, you have to look to the long term, and they weren't doing it.
And also had a lot of very decently paid workers where you could really realize the American dream at that time.
Yes, you could, but they were the beneficiaries of what I would call monopoly wages. In monopolies, it's relatively easy to pass on costs. So why would you want to fight with your unions and your workers? Why not just give them a raise and pass the costs on to the consumer?
Listen, we've got to go to break right now. When we get back, we're going to look at a couple of other industries, and I have vivid memories, both when I was at Business International and then doing private consulting, of working with some of the baby bells just at breakup and the tremendous energy they had for new ventures, working with the trucking industry. I had a client in trucking, and they had me follow every new development for about 10 years. But we got to go to break now. One more thing. We are going to be talking about in this show about how to tame the biggest billion-pound gorilla sitting on the U.S. economy, which is healthcare. So don't go away. We'll be back in 2 minutes.
When it comes to business, you'll find the experts here. Voice America Business Network. Need to hold focus groups in 7 countries or interview doctors in 57? Global Reach can get it done. Trying to expand into new markets, Global Reach will help you assess the opportunities, scope out the competition, and understand the risks. We are a strategic business intelligence firm with a network spanning over 60 countries. We can support your clinical trial recruitment campaign or identify the best practices to use when global branding. Founder and former editor of Business International, Tay Revez, brings 30 years of experience in helping companies from financial service to high tech to healthcare. She was cited by Super Searchers as one of the top 12 primary researchers within the U.S. Tay excels at in-depth interviews, custom multi-country studies, and out-of-the-box challenges. She's also been a featured speaker on subjects as diverse as baby boomers and co-branded credit cards. Let us help you with your next project. We'll work closely with you to define your needs and determine actionable solutions. Please contact us at globalreach-sbi.com or call 212-877-8616.
We're always talking business. Talk to an expert. Call now, toll free, 866-472-5790. That's 866-472-5790. Voice America Business Network.
You are tuned in to Global Reach with Tay Revez. If you have a question or comment about our program, please call in to 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. Or you can send an email to trr@globalreach-sbi.com. Now, back to the program.
Welcome back, everyone. I'm here with my guest, Paul London, and we are talking about the introduction of competition to the U.S. economy in a 30-year period. And what does that mean for today's economy and for today's business climate? And as we go through this, what does this mean for Europe? What does it mean for some of the emerging markets? But right now we were looking at the not-so-competitive U.S. economy of the 60s through the 90s. We talked about auto and steel, and you were kind of getting into some of the government-supported oligopolies, truck, air, telecom. How did that come about? What was the restraint on economic growth
really
there?
Really interesting, Tay, because AT&T, for example, which was basically the monopoly phone company, had treated its customers badly. They didn't understand that the customers didn't like their high-handed methods, and
not
so
businesses
when
and not individuals, both.
Well, it was mostly the companies. The companies objected. Companies like, well, some of the very big American companies weren't able to connect two factories next to each other without paying AT&T. So it's a long story, but eventually along came MCI, Microwave Communications, a small firm out in Illinois. And they got a hearing before the Federal Communications Commission. And AT&T was amazed that the businesses who were its customers, who they thought were happy, all supported having competition from MCI. And so AT&T was upended by other businesses. And that happened in the early 70s, in the Ford administration, basically.
You know, I did... at the time that they broke up AT&T, I was working with what became 9X. It was the New York, New England telecom group. And they were as excited as they could possibly be about getting out on their own. And they had me talk to about 100 companies to find out what they wanted from what was then called Bypass.
Mm-hmm.
And it's interesting you say customer service was the top thing. I need someone who will be there if my phones go down, so we're operational, so I don't have a plant that stopped for 4 hours. Couldn't get it from AT&T.
Right. I interviewed in the book a man who said, that competition in telephones allowed him to reduce his costs by 97%. He was using hugely more telecommunications for data transfer and things like that. And yet his costs were a fraction of what they had been under AT&T earlier.
And you can look at the cost of international calls today.
Yeah.
They are, again, a small fraction of what they were.
Right. And then other countries copied us. I mean, in some places, other countries have gone further than we have. This is true in the electric area, where we did a certain amount of introduced a certain amount of price competition, but people don't understand that the states in the United States are still very powerful, and they maintain high electric rates. They don't really want competition because it threatens some powerful interests.
And yet, if I do some work with some utilities, they're always telling me, go before the rate commission, or they're always trying to hold us down.
Yes, well, they do try to hold them down.
I've worked with them to help them assemble cases for, you know, to take before the rate commissioners.
But competition is better than regulators at holding prices down. You know, when you really start to compete, amazing things happen, things that people didn't expect. And that's what happened in telephones. People really didn't expect the cost of phone services to drop as much as they did. All the studies thought there would be a small drop, but they turned out to be very big drops in cost.
And you had an explosion of services at the same time.
Absolutely.
And an explosion of innovation.
Right.
So, of course, then you had the baby bells start to come together and form larger companies all over again.
Yeah. It concerns me. I think the drive, you know, Adam Smith was very aware that when businessmen got together, they tried to figure out ways to fix prices. And what the system has to try to avoid, this competition, what the political system has to do is put a brake on this and prevent people from getting from evading competition. They're always going to try, and you have to have ways to prevent them from succeeding.
Let's talk about another area that has had, at best we can say, mixed results: financial services. On the one hand, again, you had a great liberation, proliferation of services, and proliferation of players. On the other, we had a global crash. We've had consumers who've been gouged. We have all kinds of redlining and you know, players that have produced products that nobody understands.
Right.
So, talk to us about financial services industries, the good, the bad, and the perfectly horrible.
Well, you know, I'm a great admirer of Alexander Hamilton, who I sometimes tell people I think was the best economist we ever had. Hmm. In 1792, he had to deal with a financial panic in New York. And speculations have been a part of the American scene since before the American Revolution. I think John Kenneth Galbraith, the famous economist from back in the 60s and 70s, wrote about 20 of these financial collapses. Somebody wrote a very good book 3 or 4 years ago saying that the worst idea out there is the, quote, this time it's different. There are always financial speculations. And the government has to, that is, some government supervision is required to prevent these speculations from getting out of hand. We had a terrible speculation in the 1920s that we didn't stop. I think Greenspan was really responsible. The Federal Reserve had the authority, had the ability, had the reputation to stop the speculation that was going on in the early 2000s, and he just didn't do it. He thought the business people would avoid it all by themselves without any government supervision, and he was squarely wrong.
Hmm. So what do we do? You bring up an interesting point. You bring regulation, because clearly one of the great tug-of-wars we've had has been deregulation versus re-regulation versus new regulation. Can you have a functioning economy if we did away with all regulation the way some of those in Congress and the way business sometimes sounds like they want? Would that work? Would we unleash even more competition and have more growth, lower inflation, more employment?
Look, I say in the book, and I've always believed, that the American Constitution is a document that sets rules for political competition. you need to set rules for economic competition so that we don't have a drive to the bottom. Tennyson called the sort of competition, he said it was like nature red in tooth and claw. We can't have that kind of competition. And it's very hard to find just the right amount of regulation. But I try not to use the word regulation and deregulation. I try to say we want to promote competition. You have to be sure there is competition. This is not just an issue of efficiency. It's an issue you need to maintain, because somebody will look efficient when they have a monopoly, and then you find out after they sort of get a tight grip that there are alternatives that would have been better. So you always have to be promoting competition, economic competition and political competition.
So we've got just a couple minutes to break right now, and we're going to continue with this, but is the competition solution relevant to the political and economic climate we have today? And I'm talking about political bloodletting and complete paralysis in the U.S. and globalization. And I'd also be interested to know if it would work in stagnant Europe.
Well, they try to make it work in stagnant Europe, but looking at the United States again, whatever you can say, we're having slow growth. It's not what we want, but it's again, it's like in earlier periods. We're doing better than most of the other countries that are like us. We're doing better than most of Europe, with maybe the exception of Germany. One of the most flattering things that's happened to me with this book is that Mario Monti, who became the Prime Minister of Italy, called me out of the blue and asked if he could translate it into Italian.
Because Mario Monti was the reformist Italian prime minister who really tried to enact a lot of reforms in Italy, some of which he actually got through.
Yes, but reform means competition. The two are synonymous. If you want to have a flexible economy, you have to have competition. You have to have people rise or companies rise and fall. They have to see the sight of the gallows to stay efficient. And, you know, in Italy, this has been a problem. It's a problem in France, many other places. So, you know, I was very flattered that Mario Monti wanted to translate the book, because our experience is relevant to the rest of the world.
I want to talk more, and we've got to go to break now, about the competition solution for today's economy. And I've got a question that's come in from one of our listeners, which we're going to deal with in the next segment, which has to do with energy. But don't go away, because we'll be back in 2 minutes.
Voice America Business Network, the bottom line in business.
Need to hold focus groups in 7 countries or interview doctors in 57? Global Reach can get it done. Trying to expand into new markets, Global Reach will help you assess the opportunities, scope out the competition, and understand the risks. We are a strategic business intelligence firm with a network spanning over 60 countries. We can support your clinical trial recruitment campaign or identify the best practices to use when global branding. Founder and former editor of Business International, Tay Revez, brings 30 years of experience in helping companies from financial service to high tech to healthcare. She was cited by Super Searchers as one of the top 12 primary researchers within the U.S. Tay excels at in-depth interviews, custom multi-country studies, and out-of-the-box challenges. She's also been a featured speaker on subjects as diverse as baby boomers and co-branded credit cards. Let us help you with your next project. We'll work closely with you to define your needs and determine actionable solutions. Please contact us at globalreach-sbi.com or call 212-877-8616.
From the boardroom to you, Voice America Business Network.
are tuned in to Global Reach with Tay Revez. If you have a question or comment about our program, please call in to 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. Or you can send an email to trr@globalreach-sbi.com. Now, back to the program.
Welcome back to our third segment, everyone. This is your host, Tay Revez, and I'm here with Dr. Paul London, and we are talking about the competition solution. So can more competition solve the U.S. economy in the 90s? Sorry, can we get 90s-style growth and 90s-style employment levels in the 2010s?
I think, you know, the world is a little bit different now. Then we were looking at, Europe was doing very poorly. Japan was the big competitor at the time, not China. But I think the U.S. economy remains significantly stronger than almost anywhere else in the world because we have so much competition here. A lot of the innovations in the world are coming from the United States. So I'm hopeful about the economy. I think this economy, imagine now, Russia is slowing down, China is slowing down, Europe is very in a quite a deep recession. The United States is growing. That's pretty good. That tells you that the kind of flexible economy we have because of competition is strong even in bad times.
See, this is a different world, and it's a good time for me to bring in this question that we received right before break from Barry Waldron. He's the director at the Southeast Michigan Land Conservancy, and he was a guest on this show talking about water and energy.
Mm-hmm.
And his question for you is, Dr. London, what were oil and gas prices in the glorious 1990s and the economy of the glorious 1990s, and how do you imagine we can regain that economy in a 21st century reality of $100 a barrel oil? I don't think liberating people's vital energies will stimulate investment and drive costs down magically when real energy costs are five times what they were in the 1990s.
Energy costs were really important in lowering inflation during the 80s and the 90s. The caller or the writer is certainly right that they're much higher now. But a lot of things are happening in the energy area. And they're what has driven these prices up, and they're what's leading to a lot of innovation. The fracking, all the natural gas that's coming on. One of the big problems is that Japan has become a huge market for oil and China because of the pollution in China and the nuclear shutdowns in Japan. So that's what's holding up the oil price. It's pretty amazing.
And we have record coal exports to China at this point.
Yes, we do. We have record coal exports. But it's amazing that we've had no inflation in the United States, really no inflation in the United States for 30 years, despite these gyrations in the oil price.
Well, this isn't the show to talk about fracking and coal and some of the other effects that those are going to have long-term on the economy, but I will mention there was an article I saw today about a project, and I think it's South Carolina, where they're putting blue tape on the doors of coastal merchants, mm-hmm. showing where they expect the waters to rise to in the next 10 to 40 years.
Well, I think it's, I believe in global warming. I'm up here in Western Mass, and the lake is warmer than I can remember, and I've been coming here since 1950. So I believe in global warming. But I think I also believe in fracking because I think natural gas is a lot cleaner than either coal or oil. And I hope the Chinese, who are supposed to be sitting on a lot of natural gas, begin to develop it. And again, this will be developed with American technology from the competitive American energy industry,
which the U.S. is certainly pushing the exports of. It's a subject I'm going to deal with. I want to deal with in a future show, and we've started to deal with it in earlier shows. But one of the things that I find really critical is to look at the balance between, particularly the impact of horizontal fracking on water, particularly on potable water, mm-hmm. and what those costs and what the balance is for our long-term economy and survivability. Because there is evidence coming out of western Pennsylvania, Texas, that there are a lot of negative effects to groundwater and drinking water and the need for other industries to have pure, clean water to drink, well, feed livestock, to grow crops with.
You know, I've done a lot of work in the energy area. I used to work with Hydro-Québec, which had, a lot of hydropower to send to New England. There are always objections to these things. There are vested interests. There are environmental interests. There, you know, the coal people don't like the natural gas emphasis. There, you have to look at the politics as we did in all these other areas where we introduced competition. Competition gores somebody. People lose. There are losers in competition. And they can make a lot of noise. So I discount some of the noise that I hear.
Well, isn't the question partly what you lose? I mean, water, once polluted, you don't get it back. And like money, it's fungible. Once you pollute the water, the groundwater, it can go anywhere. And I tell you, it wasn't a loser that really got me interested in this subject. It was a report by Goldman Sachs on water being the petroleum of the 21st century.
Well, I think there's hydro. At one point, Canada was talking about exporting water to the United States. I mean, they have a lot of frozen water up there. But you know, I all of these issues have to be dealt with, and they will. You know, that's what the political system does. It lets people in to discuss these issues. I think it's a mistake to think that we know all the answers at this point.
So let's talk about the current political climate in the U.S. and the question of more competition, but competition that isn't, shall we say, a complete win-lose. I know some people get hurt. The question is how many, who, and how permanent the damage is, and whether what you're creating is contributes more than what you're losing.
Yes.
So we have a system that is really heavily dominated by money, by special interests, by corporate, tremendous amount of, let's say, corporate investment in the political process. Next week we're going to have Robert Monks on this show, and he's going to talk about his brand new book called Citizens Disunited, which is a look at kind of the corporatization of U.S. policy, that they have far more influence now than they did at the periods we were talking about. And clearly it's in a company's interest to, you know, act in its own interest and those of its stakeholders. But how do you create healthy competition and competition that's positive for the economy in that kind of environment? You have a lot of government experience and political experience.
Let's start using the example from the book of AT&T. But it's an example that runs through the book in other industries. AT&T spent more money on lobbyists than anybody else in Washington. AT&T wanted to maintain its monopoly in telephones. The union, the communications workers of America, were united with the company in wanting to preserve the monopoly. The unions understood very well that as long as AT&T had a monopoly, their workers would be paid monopoly wages. They would be paid very well. AT&T and the union lost. They lost. They couldn't even get people to introduce their bills toward the end of this period in the 1980s. So I think that sometimes we exaggerate the ability of money. And usually there's money on both sides. I don't think that the business community is so united, and certainly they weren't in the area that I discuss in my book. The business community tends to be on different sides of issues. And I expect that to continue. I think we worry. I think this all this emphasis on money is exaggerated.
Well, I wonder if it is. Doesn't really look like it, but I hope you're right. I ask you one of the
things
that...
I hope I'm right, too, Tay, let me tell you. but I think I'm right. I look at the experience in these other industries where, you know, the steel workers and the steel companies wanted to maintain essentially the oligopoly in steel, and they lost. The auto workers and the auto companies wanted to maintain the oligopoly in the automobile area, and they lost. The powerful interests lose a lot of times in Washington, including the oil industry. I think if you look at the history of this, you'll find that these powerful interests get rolled more often than people expect.
Hmm. So, we talked about the low inflation and that mm-hmm. this was unleashing competition, but it also meant that you had basically stagnating wages and stagnating personal incomes, which other than the really top tier of the U.S., has been pretty pervasive since at least the 90s. And now that's the market, that's our new market. If you're going to continue to stagnate wages, you're going to have a group of people who can only afford to shop at Walmart, and that's going to be a very large group of people, say about 80% of us, or at least the 47%. But one of the things that I thought was interesting about the period is that we were talking about Alan Greenspan. Alan Greenspan's hypothesis for the low level of inflation was because traumatized workers, his words, who felt really insecure about their jobs in a changing economy, couldn't demand wage increases. Now, if anything, people are less secure now. What does that do to the vast buying, to a consumption society, which the U.S. is?
Well, I'm not a big fan of Alan Greenspan.
I've noticed.
I think it's certainly true that when you have a very soft labor market like we have now, workers don't get higher wages. When you have a strong labor market like we had when unemployment was only 3.9%, when we have a strong labor market, workers do get increases. And I think that's the healthiest place for them to come from.
But he didn't, I mean, Greenspan was talking about the 90s when there was very, very little wage pressure. And I was looking at something from Robert Pollan, who's at Department of Economics and Political Economy at UMass. And he's saying, again, at that period, workers' bargaining strength was really, really weak.
Yeah,
even
but
though
wages
we were, at
were rising.
So,
wages were rising at the end of the 90s. It wasn't because it was because people were competing for labor, and that, it seems to me, is a good situation. You want people to be competing for labor. When they need labor, they train labor. They put them into schools. They encourage them to go to community colleges. When the labor market is strong, people get training and they get all sorts of things that they don't get when the labor market is weak. And
on that
now
very
we're
positive
in a...
note, Paul, we've got to go to break. When we get back, I want to talk about why Ben Bernanke has things wrong and also your specific target, your favorite target, for competition, that multi-trillion-dollar gorilla sitting on the U.S. economy, healthcare costs.
I'll look forward to that.
So don't go away.
All right.
From the boardroom to you, Voice America Business Network.
Need to hold focus groups in 7 countries or interview doctors in 57? Global Reach can get it done. Trying to expand into new markets, Global Reach will help you assess the opportunities, scope out the competition, and understand the risks. We are a strategic business intelligence firm with a network spanning over 60 countries. We can support your clinical trial recruitment campaign or identify the best practices to use when global branding. Founder and former editor of Business International, Tay Revez, brings 30 years of experience in helping companies from financial service to high tech to healthcare. She was cited by Super Searchers as one of the top 12 primary researchers within the U.S. Tay excels at in-depth interviews, custom multi-country studies, and out-of-the-box challenges. She's also been a featured speaker on subjects as diverse as baby boomers and co-branded credit cards. Let us help you with your next project. We'll work closely with you to define your needs and determine actionable solutions. Please contact us at globalreach-sbi.com or call 212-877-8616. We're always talking business.
Talk to an expert.
Call now, toll free, 866-472-5790. That's 866-472-5790. Voice America Business Network. Are tuned in to Global Reach with Tay Revez. If you have a question or comment about our program, please call in to 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. Or you can send an email to trr@globalreach-sbi.com. Now, back to the program.
Hi, welcome back to our final segment. I'm here with Paul London, and he's going to tell me why Ben Bernanke and so many others have it wrong. What do they have wrong, Paul?
Well, I think I like Ben Bernanke a lot because he brings a historic perspective to monetary policy. I think he was under the influence of Greenspan, very concerned about inflation, but he's grown in the job. He's applying this historic experience with the Depression, which is, what he specialized in. And I think now he's much more worried about deflation, about falling prices, than he is about rising prices. So, you know, for 25 years, people talked about nothing but inflation. And I think the discussion now, you almost never hear it. In fact, just in the last week, the Open Market Committee met, and, of course, inflation is very, very low. So I think Bernanke has done a very good job.
We don't have time to deal with it here, but I do remember a lot of concerns about Japan being in a deflationary economy and the damage that did to employment. You said something, Gary. I want to go, before we go to the next topic, what about deficits? We have such a preoccupation in Congress about deficits. And when we were talking before the show, you made a very interesting point about presidents who bought into the zero deficit policy. Now, the deficit fell under Clinton, so that was a good thing. But you had a very interesting point about...
Well, people who've really focused on the deficit, and there was a piece in the New York Times this weekend, people who really tried to, have hard money and reduce the deficit, have usually done so and led to a depression. We've had very bad experiences with these things in the 1830s, in the 1870s, in the 1890s, in the 1920s. I think this preoccupation with deficits is a big mistake. And again, to return to our friend Ben Bernanke, that's what he's saying. He's saying that we're spending much too much time worrying about deficits when we have this immediate problem, which is unemployment. I mean, if we got unemployment down, if we were growing faster, the deficits would be shrinking in any case.
Okay, let's move on to what is your favorite candidate for competitive liberation in the U.S. economy now? What could unleash a lot of energy?
Look, there are two areas where we have very little modernization as a result of competition. That is, competition has not been able to lead to the modernization of our education industry, if I can call it an industry, and it has not been able to lead to rapid modernization of our healthcare industry.
Well, we don't have time to do both, so I'm picking healthcare.
Let's do healthcare. Healthcare, we have all this new equipment, and unlike in other industries, it seems to lead to rising prices, not falling prices.
Absolutely.
And this is unnatural. It new equipment usually leads to falling prices, but there are so many interests in the healthcare industry that want to maintain the present structure of the industry. If you go through any, I'm up here in New England now. You go through any town in New England, the largest employer, the last of the smokestack industries, is the hospital. It's a huge employer of basically low-wage workers with a lot of high-wage doctors and administrators. It's the last of the smokestack industries. It is really, in structure, unmodernized. In equipment, it's modernized. But in structure, the healthcare industry is not modern. And, we have to get to a modern industry here to lower costs.
When you say structure, and we've literally got 4 minutes to the end of the show, what do you mean by the structure's uncompetitive?
Well, you have a bunch of boutiques like there's no A&P in healthcare. There's no Walmart in healthcare. What you have is a bunch of little doctor's offices like general stores out in some country town.
Although we are seeing some of the private health care companies buying up those doctors' practices and buying up hospitals.
Some of them. But it isn't happening very fast, and you still have a very local industry. It's not a national health care industry. It's not even a statewide health care industry. If we had 150 Kaisers competing.
Kaiser Permanente? Out of California?
Yes, which owns its own hospitals, has its own doctors, is an integrated system that looks more like other industries in the United States. I think then we would have costs in the United States that are significantly lower than you have in Europe. It's just unbelievable that these socialist countries in Europe, sort of known for their inefficiency in many areas, are more efficient than we are in healthcare. It is the structure of the industry. Local monopolies are very hard to dislodge, and that's what.
Paul.
Yes.
We've got your premise in the book is that there was bipartisan policymaking that created competition, or created a competitive playing field in all these other industries: steel, automotive, telecom. What policy needs do we have from the U.S. government, and can you get them when the House keeps trying? Its only thing it ever seems to be doing is trying to repeal Obamacare.
Well, I think that's going to be very difficult at the national level. This is a local industry that probably needs to be opened up to competition at the local level. I'm not sure, many people I've talked to about this say, look, just we're staying away from health care in this competitive when we talk about competition, because it is local monopolies that are hard to break. And there are lots of articles on this. I know we're running short of time. But there are lots of things that talk about how these particular hospitals just dominate areas.
And one area, and we've literally got a minute, that we both agree on is the spread of electronic medical records. And I know that there's at least one industry, which is the smart card industry, which is backing this to the hilt, and it's something that's been employed in Europe, in Germany, in France, in Japan, in Korea. They all have not just electronic medical records, but your medical record can go on a smart card, which is a card with a microchip on it that contains your whole formulary, your whole insurance, and can contain all your medical records.
Well, I've been interested in this for over 20 years, and it just is happening very slowly because, as in other industries, there is so much opposition. Doctors will tell you, oh, I don't like them, I heard Newt Gingrich, of all people, say, look, if a pilot doesn't like radar, we don't let him fly. But if a doctor doesn't like electronic records, he continues to use paper records. And he screws up the whole system because, some people are on paper, some people are on electronic. So I think this is a first step. In fact, I would have been very happy if we hadn't had, this big effort at change, but we had just imposed, really forced doctors to use electronic medical records.
The Health Information Portability Act, HIPAA, calls for electronic medical records, and the ACA, Obamacare, also has a really major effort on electronic records. You know, we're out of time. I hate to say this, but we run out of time. We got 1 minute in which I just want to thank you so much for being on the show. I think we're going to have to pick this up again.
I hope so.
And next week, my first guest host will be Nate Sapaya. He's the editor of Alternative Emerging Investor, and he's going to interview Professor Andrew Karoly. Now, he is the director of the Emerging Markets Institute at Cornell, which is the only emerging market institute in the U.S. He's also under contract to write a book on emerging markets for Oxford, and they are really going to talk about hot issue and reality versus myth in emerging markets. On August 15th, the following week, Robert Monks is going to be on. We're going to talk about Citizens Disunited, the U.S. Crisis in Governance. On August 22nd, Dr. Thomas Weifel is going to be calling in from Switzerland. We're going to talk about culture clash and what that means for your cross-border business. And in the future, and we don't have a date yet, Maria Inahosa is going to be talking about business economics and immigration. So, Paul, again, thank you for coming on Global Reach.
Thank you, Tay. I've enjoyed it.
And how can anybody reach you if they want to?
Well, they could go through the Stern Group, that's be one way. Or
www.thesterngroup.biz.
Right.
Okay. So thank you. And for my guest, Paul London, and myself, we wish you great success in extending your global reach, and join us next week.
Thank you for listening to Global Reach with Tay Revez. Please join us again next Thursday at 11 a.m. Pacific Time, 2 p.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Business Channel. Have a great week.